Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It is not just Friday, it's follow-up Friday. This summer we're using part of our Friday time to dig deeper on some threads of conversation that we touched on briefly during the week, but that we think deserve a conversation of their own. Today we have three follow-up Friday segments. In a little while, we'll talk about another thing that came up in the Edwards interview. He seemed to feel strongly about crack cocaine and powder cocaine getting people different sentences if they're convicted for possession or sale, and he sees that as a racial differential. So we will follow up on why prison time is different for powder versus crack cocaine. And later we'll talk about 100 words that are misused to confuse. A follow-up on our 100 words that every high school graduate should know segment from recently. And right now, however, we talked briefly yesterday with columnist Mike Kelly from The Record about the fact that gay and lesbian couples in New Jersey are not signing up under the new civil unions law in the state as fast as they signed up for domestic partnership status back when that took effect. Even though civil unions are considered legally more advanced, that is closer to legal marriage. So we thought we would follow up now on what that means with William Eskridge, a law professor at Yale and author of the book Gay Marriage for Better or Worse. Dr. Eskridge, Professor Eskridge, welcome back to WNYC. Hi there.
It's always a pleasure. Thanks.
And I also want to open up the phones here for any listeners who are currently in either arrangement. If you are in New Jersey or anywhere and are either in a domestic partnership or a civil union, call us up and tell us how it works for you and what the legal status has enabled you to do or does not enable you to do that you think it should. 212-433-WNYC for anyone in a domestic partnership or civil union. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Professor Eskridge, legally speaking, what's the difference?
Well, legally speaking, there are very few differences between a civil union of the sort that Vermont and Connecticut and New Jersey have recognized and a marriage, such as has been recognized in Massachusetts for same-sex couples, and that's now stuck in Massachusetts after the legislature's refusal to pass along a constitutional amendment. The main effect might be interstate recognition in terms of legal effect. It might indeed be that one will be more likely to be recognized, say, in other countries, such as the countries of Europe or other states. But at this point, it's not entirely clear whether that would be civil union or marriage. 27 states have, by constitutional amendment, defined marriage as one man or one woman. And a few of those states have also excluded civil unions, but most of them have not. So ironically, it might indeed be a more portable, i.e. recognized in other states arrangement, if you're involved in a civil union than if you're involved in a same-sex marriage. So legally, it doesn't explain the much lower numbers that you're reporting, I think, accurately in New Jersey.
How do you, I guess it's speculation to ask why you think New Jerseyans are not signing up for these civil unions, which are generally considered a higher legal status than domestic partnership, given the opportunity now in the last few months?
There are three things going on, very briefly. Thing number one is that, as you pointed out, New Jersey had earlier recognized domestic partnerships. So a lot of the pent-up demand had already been expended on the first statutory recognition that New Jersey had several years ago, even though it didn't have nearly as many legal benefits and obligations attached to it. So it might indeed be that the initial wave was the big wave, and we've seen that in other states, that once either marriage or civil unions are offered, there'll be a big explosion of pent-up demand, and then there'll be a steady trickle, but nowhere near that level. The second thing is that a lot of couples are holding out for marriage. We now have that in Massachusetts. It's been confirmed. There's not going to be a constitutional amendment to change that. And so Massachusetts led the way. Canada, the Netherlands, Belgium, South Africa, Spain. Same-sex marriage is recognized in various parts of the world. And so a lot of gay and lesbian couples consider themselves married. Many of them have gotten married in church ceremonies. And they're not willing to enter into a state relationship that's only called a civil union.
Let's take a phone call from someone in a civil union. Sybil in Queens, you're on WNYC. Hi, thanks for calling.
Thank you for having me. Hello?
Yes.
Yes. My partner, we got civil union because we were expecting a baby.
Mm-hmm. Congratulations.
With the hopes that we could both be in the baby's birth certificate. However, it is not working like that. She has to adopt the child, and I have to give birth, and the birth certificate will look like I am a single mom, and we have to go through the adoption. If we were heterosexual couple married, that would not be the case.
What state is your civil union registered in?
Jersey.
So, Professor Eskridge, this sounds right to you. Legally, they would not get the right to have both names on the birth certificate?
That doesn't sound right to me, but unfortunately, a lot of the issues that come up under these domestic partnership and civil union statutes aren't clearly resolved until people like your wonderful caller go to court or go to the state and sort of ask for clarification. Normally, under civil union, this is certainly true in Vermont and Connecticut, the way it works, is that they could both be on the birth certificate. But again, New Jersey, we have an entirely new statute, and a lot of it does depend on the way the governor and the other state officials say that it's going to be enforced.
So
I would urge them to at least ask. And if the local official says no, maybe pose a question to their state legislator or even as high as the governor's office.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, good luck, and I congratulate you as well.
Sybil, have you considered having the baby somewhere in Vermont? Then maybe you'd get a Vermont birth certificate and you can do it?
Oh, boy.
That's a big step.
I'm not sure if that's feasible.
Honey, I'm going into labor. Let's get on the
right.
Amtrak now and go to Burlington. Maybe not. Sybil, good luck.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Now, would that even work if they went to the other state that, you know, where you could have both both gay parents on the birth certificate and the baby was born there? Would it then be a state of Vermont or a state of Massachusetts birth certificate? And it would be written up that way, or am I overthinking this?
Well, I think you have a very clever suggestion for them. Yeah, sure. If they went to Vermont and the child were born there, Vermont would recognize, almost certainly, a New Jersey civil union for purposes of Vermont law. And I think the same probably is true, though not as clear in Massachusetts, ironically enough. And so, yes, there'd be a Vermont birth certificate, and the parents would be listed as the two women who are joined in civil union. Now, I would warn them that Amtrak usually runs behind, and there is a possibility they would be born on the Amtrak train.
In the wrong state.
Well, possibly, although the good news is that Amtrak goes through Connecticut, Massachusetts, and Vermont at that point. And all three of those states recognize either civil union or same-sex marriage.
You know, we have nobody else calling in right now who's in a domestic partnership or a civil union. Come on, where are you folks? Don't be so shy. You must be out there. Or is it such a beautiful Friday morning that nobody's listening to the radio anymore? You're all out walking in the park. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Although, actually, there aren't that many people in this entire universe. I think it's 1,000-something civil unions in New Jersey and 1,000-something domestic partnerships, Professor Eskridge?
Right. I don't have the most current figures, but that sounds right to me. And, you know, as you pointed out, there was not a rush for people to join this new statute that New Jersey has just passed. And a lot of those people are probably not listening to the radio. They're changing diapers or they're at work.
You know, but here we go.
Both these couples are very
hard-working. Eight lines, nine. Now all of our 10 lines are ringing. So I think we just smoke people out there. Okay, here's somebody. Can I go right to Eric in Englewood? Eric in Englewood is in a couple, he seems to be telling our screener, but they're actually holding out. Can I just take line two there? Eric, you're on the air. Hi.
Hi there. Thank you so much for
Thank
taking
you.
My call.
So what's your
I'm
situation?
I'm in a relationship that has one immigrant, and the problem, of course, is that the federal government is not prepared to recognize the state movements as far as gay marriage. So I'm holding out until something comes along that will help me with my immigrant situation.
What about for the immigrant situation, Professor Eskridge?
Well, I have bad news on that front. The Defense of Marriage Act, which President Clinton and Senator Dole pushed through Congress in 1996, means that as a matter of federal law, even if all 50 states recognize same-sex marriage, federal law relating to spousehood and marriage would never include same-sex couples. So DOMA, which is not going to be repealed in the current administration, is an insuperable barrier along those lines. But what I would urge Eric and his partner to do is to contact their senators and their representative, and there has been agitation within Congress to amend the immigration law to create a new status, as has been done in Canada, Australia, and other civilized countries, a new status which would not be tied to marriage and would allow on a case-by-case basis committed partners to come in along some of the same lines that non-national spouses are now able to come into the United States. And that's our best hope at this point, piecemeal reform.
Alan in Plainfield, you're on WNYC. Hi, Alan. Whoops, let me press that button again. Alan, you're on the air. Hi there.
Hi, good morning. You coaxed me out of the woodwork.
All right. I knew you were out there.
Yes. My partner and I had a civil union on February 23rd, the first day in Plainfield that we could actually have a ceremony. And we actually were married in an Episcopal church in Secaucus by Mark Lewis, who was one of the lead couples who brought this case against the state of New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
But this is working out fine. And I guess the main impetus is that we had lived also in New Jersey for about not quite 4 years, and we had not registered our domestic partnership just because we were lazy about getting around to it. And this was, I guess, the extra momentum that we needed to, you know, do that. So.
And for people who are presumably holding out until there's full marriage in New Jersey, what would you say?
You know, why wait? You know, life's too short. You know, it's too short.
Alan, thanks for your call. And Professor Eskridge, what seems to be happening in New Jersey right now, I guess we should remember that the legislature was ordered by the court, the state Supreme Court, to come up with something that ended partnership discrimination against same-sex couples. And they had the choice, basically, or the legislature decided that they had the choice between marriage and civil unions. And they chose to remedy it with civil unions, which they said gives all the legal rights and benefits of marriage, but without the political risks of using the M word. So is that your understanding of how we got here in New Jersey? And do you think ultimately that will stand if revisited by the court?
Brian, that's exactly how we got where we are. I think you've stated it exactly correctly. And it also goes back to Sybil's original question. So she ought to have the same ability to put her partner's name on the birth certificate as married couples. And so I would ask them to revisit that with their either local official or their state senator. The further thing to say that Alan has raised, and it's very important, is that, yes, the legislature, I think, accurately understood what the court was saying in Lewis. It's been left up to the legislature for the time being. But the real sort of normative debate now is back at the ground level, and Alan, I think, crystallized it perfectly. People are voting with their feet, either joining in civil union or not, but they're also going to their churches and their communities. It doesn't have to be a religious ceremony. But I think Alan and his partner, it sounds like, consider their union, not just a state-sanctioned civil union, they think that's good, but they also consider it a marriage. And I bet you the dozens or maybe even hundreds of people who attended the religious ceremony in Secaucus agreed with them. The minister, the officiator, their friends, their family, their co-workers, people who wandered in off the streets, probably most of those people agree with them, yes, this is a marriage. This is holy, this is committed, this is entitled to all of the sort of social respect and traditional endearment that we've associated with marriage. And at a point where most of the citizens of New Jersey can agree with that proposition, usually by knowing gay and lesbian, married, and civil unioned couples, working with them, seeing their children, etc., then at that point, you know, at some point it will be uncontroversial for the legislature simply to segue from civil union to marriage. I think It's probably better that it come from the legislature. But say in 10 years, if public opinion has shifted and the legislature is recalcitrant for some reason, it might well come and legitimately come from the courts who say there really is no longer any kind of legitimate state reason not to give the full equality as to nomenclature as well as to the rights and duties.
Dorothy in Teaneck, you're on WNYC. Hello, Dorothy.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, thank you.
I just called because I was listening and I was just really angered about how light, you know, I mean, to think that these people's lives, these people, my life, you know, I've been with my same partner since 1982, and nobody's even mentioned anything like common law, marriage with us, things like this woman having to take a train to some other state, you know, like we've got that kind of money to just bandy about. I mean, it's just, I mean, you just had an episode, you had a conversation about people in poverty. I mean, and nobody discusses the fact that gays stay married in heterosexual relationships to raise their children. I mean, it just goes on and on. It's obvious we can raise children. We stay in loveless marriages for 30 years because our children need to grow up and prosper in a country where everything is condemned. And then to make light of this woman's situation, I mean, it just goes on and on and on. And the reason we're not getting married, I mean, I can't even use the phrase. The whole question is preposterous.
And yet,
it's heartbreaking.
And yet, here we are. And I hope that wasn't insulting to anybody. I think we were just, you know, having very sympathetic fun with that caller and trying to come up with creative solutions.
But there is no fun. For our lives,
yes.
There is no fun.
Well,
none.
I don't know that all gay people feel that way and that the whole conversation has to take place in totally serious, angry, earnest tones. I'm not even sure that does the most possible to humanize gay and lesbians to heterosexuals. But I don't know.
I understand that. I'm just saying to make light of the seriousness.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are some things you can make light of, but there are issues that we're not covering. And sometimes, you know, the reason that it takes so long is because we continue to digress. I mean, every opportunity, oh, let's take a break from all the seriousness. No one would say that if somebody walked in and said, you two, nobody cares if you're married. Nobody cares. Married, what the heck is that? That's just a word. It's just a phrase. It means nothing to us.
Dorothy, thank you very much. I appreciate your concern. And William Eskridge, anything you want to say in response to Dorothy?
Let me pick up on this very important point that Dorothy has raised. She's made a couple of very good points, particularly. One is, a lot of society just refuses to talk about gay and lesbian relationships as marriages. Now, that's a much lower percentage than even 10 years ago. But still, that is true of a lot of society. A lot of society socially and legally denigrates very loving and committed same-sex relationships. And that is something that does need to be resisted. And it should be resisted by calls like Dorothy's, but also by calls like Alan's and Eric's and Sybil's. I think all of those sort of different calls emphasize this. The other thing is that the conversation also tends to forget, because the plaintiffs in these lawsuits tend to be middle-class professionals, you know, very happy and prosperous plaintiffs.
Right.
What the conversation does often forget is, number one, the violence against gays and lesbians, particularly gays and lesbians of color, particularly single parents who are often gay and lesbian or transgendered, particularly unemployed gays and lesbians. There's a lot of violence and a lot of state discrimination. They're discriminated against not just on their sexual orientation, but also their race and their class. And I must say, you need to step back even on the same-sex marriage debate, that marriage is not a panacea for all of the problems that these loving couples and gay and lesbian people raise.
There are still lots of other things on the discrimination front, for example, that would persist even with legal marriage.
That's right. And so this is, although and, one thing to be said.
And we've got 20 seconds left, Professor Eskridge. Go ahead.
One thing to be said in addition for it is a kind of a social insurance program. It is a signal that the state sends to people that whatever difficulties you're going to have in life, health and economic and other difficulties, marriage can help you work through them, and the state will support you on that. You'll get health care benefits from your employer, at least in many cases. There'll be duties of support and whatnot. And now, probably Dorothy, and certainly I, think the state should be doing more, you know, particularly for people raising children who need child care, particularly for pregnant women who are often discriminated against by their employers, whatever orientation the women are. But same-sex marriage can fit perhaps minorly into that conversation as well.
Yale law professor William Eskridge, author of Gay Marriage for Better or Worse, thanks so much excuse me, for coming on with us today.
Brian, it's always a pleasure, and always intelligent and excellent comments from your listeners.
Thanks so much on behalf of those listeners. And when we continue in a minute, more Follow-Up Friday, we'll follow up on something else that John Edwards said in that interview that we aired last hour about the difference in sentences for people convicted of crack cocaine versus powder cocaine possession and sale. And then we'll go on to the 100 words used to misuse, 100 words misused to confuse. So stay with us. See, I'm confused already. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and it's not just Friday, it's Follow-Up Friday. This summer we're using part of our Friday time to dig deeper on some threads of conversation that we touched on briefly during the week and that deserve a conversation of their own. And we're going to go right back right now to something from our interview with John Edwards at Cooper Union last night that we aired last hour. This had to do with race and drugs and justice.
I think we have a justice system that has huge inherent biases against people of color. That includes some of which are actually written into the law, the disparity between crack and powder cocaine, which has a huge impact on young African-American men.
So that went by pretty quick, but we thought we would stop and dig a little deeper on that comment by John Edwards. In fact, as the Supreme Court decided this week to consider that very topic, I have a feeling that's why he brought it up. They will consider federal sentencing practices for powder versus crack cocaine. And joining me now to enlighten us about it is Mark Maurer, Executive Director of the Sentencing Project, an advocacy group and think tank that studies exactly questions like this. Mark Maurer, welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks. Very good to be here.
What are the sentences for crack cocaine versus powder cocaine today?
Well, the mandatory sentencing laws adopted by Congress in the mid-1980s call for a person convicted of selling 500 grams of powder cocaine, it's a little over a pound, to get a mandatory 5 years in prison. But for crack cocaine, all it requires is possessing 5 grams of the drug, the weight of about 2 pennies, to get that same mandatory sentencing law. And so that's led to what people refer to as the 100-to-1 sentencing disparity. It takes 100 times more powder cocaine before you get that same mandatory 5-year sentence.
How and when did that disparity come about?
Well, it came about in two laws in 1986 and 1988. And if we remember back to that time, that was a period when this new drug, crack cocaine, was beginning to emerge in New York City, certainly in the early to mid-80s, many East Coast cities, and then spreading to other areas. And at the time, certainly in retrospect, I think there was a good deal of hysteria around the drug. There was very little analysis of what the drug was all about, where it came from, what its impact was. And the laws went through Congress literally in record time. One of the highlights at the time was the tragic death of a young man named Len Bias, University of Maryland basketball star, who was drafted number 2 in the NBA draft by the Boston Celtics, went out to celebrate with his friends that night and died of a drug overdose that was incorrectly reported as crack cocaine. Some months later it was revealed that it was actually powder cocaine, but that sort of fueled that whole dynamic, and Congress said, we've got to do something. And so without calling any witnesses or hearings, just raced this legislation through in a matter of weeks.
What did the Supreme Court just agree to hear?
Well, the Supreme Court is taking a case. They were supposed to already take a case this session, and a case called Claiborne. And unfortunately, in a tragic event, the Mr. Claiborne himself was killed in the midst of a street crime a couple of weeks ago. So the new case is called Kimbrough, and it involves a case of crack cocaine. The question is, how much discretion should sentencing judges have in these cases? The case is somewhat remarkable in some ways. Under the sentencing guidelines, Mr. Kimbrough was supposed to be sentenced to about 19 years in prison. The judge felt that the crack penalties, the way they're structured, sort of raised those levels far higher than is justified, and didn't go down very much. He went down to 15 years, still a very hefty sentence. But the question that will come before the court is how much discretion should sentencing judges have, and is the structure of the mandatory penalties so out of line that it results in overly punitive and overly disparate kinds of punishments imposed.
Does the lawsuit mention race explicitly?
It doesn't explicitly, although some of the amicus briefs that will be submitted will be addressing that. And the whole issue of race and sentencing has been addressed by the U.S. Sentencing Commission and members of Congress, where there's also a sort of parallel move right now to consider some types of sentencing reform legislation for crack cocaine, even as the Supreme Court prepares to hear this case in the fall.
When these laws were originally passed, I remember debating on the show, well, not in the 80s, but in the 90s, the notion of some people that they should be sentenced differently because the effects of the drugs are different. And powder cocaine may be illegal, may be dangerous to the individual, may have some bad effects that could, you know, lead to behavior that affects others. But statistically speaking, crack cocaine is much more likely to make the user absolutely crazy and really go off and do violent things. And so in a social sense, it really is a more dangerous drug and therefore should incur a harsher penalty for possession or sale.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about that?
Well, I think one of the sort of ironies of the current structure, the way it's set up, is that, you know, if we look at these drugs are pharmacologically the same. You know, crack cocaine is produced from powder cocaine. You just add some baking soda and cook it. So someone convicted of having 499 grams of powder cocaine just under the mandatory threshold will get at most 1 year in prison. But if that same person divides up the powder cocaine and cooks it into crack and distributes in very small quantities, 5 grams, then the person on the street corner with the 5 grams is going to get the mandatory 5 years in prison rather than the more substantial dealer, you know, who's supplying it in the first place. We do know that some users or sellers of both drugs, both crack cocaine and powder cocaine, do engage in violence. And, of course, the federal sentencing guidelines have written into them enhancements for violent conduct. And so it seems that what we've done essentially is, in the structure of the mandatory penalties, built in almost a greater, an absolute presumption of violence, so that the majority of crack offenders who were not engaged in violence are sentenced as if they all were engaged in violence. And it seems to me to be a much more rational approach to say, regardless of the drug you're convicted of, if you also engage in violence, then there will be an enhanced sentence, but we need to do that on a case-by-case basis and look at the actual activity involved.
You mentioned mandatory sentences as being at the heart of this. Here's an email that just came in on something pertinent that's in the news today. This email says, let's see what happens to Giuliani's now ex-South Carolina campaign chair, Tom Ravenel. He was charged on Tuesday with distribution of cocaine, which carries with it the potential maximum of 20 years in prison. Any chance he'll see anything close to that? What about the next guy, the one without connections? So I guess that's powder cocaine, but nevertheless, do you think that sentencing disparities come into play in, you know, cases of more privileged people or people who are white or this kind of thing?
Well, unfortunately, I think there's no question that they do. I think this case in South Carolina, if he's convicted of what he's charged with, I mean, I think it's likely that he will get a significant amount of time in prison because he's charged with some fairly high-level distribution offenses, it seems. But, you know, we've seen across the country over the last 25 years since the declaration of the war on drugs is that while we know that drug use and drug abuse cuts across lines of race and class, that the drug law enforcement, the war on drugs, has primarily targeted low-income communities and communities of color. If we look at our prison system, about three-quarters of the people serving time for a drug offense are African-American Latino. That's far out of proportion to the degree that people in those communities use or sell drugs. Now, some would say, well, you know, this has been a particular problem in low-income communities. You've got these street-corner drug markets. Who would want that in their neighborhood? And that's absolutely correct. You know, we need to do something about that. I think the problem is that we've had this two-tiered war on drugs, whereby middle-class parents who've got a kid who starts abusing drugs, you know, don't call up the police and say, would you please arrest my son or daughter? Instead, they get their kid into the best treatment program they can find, and they deal with it as a family problem, as a health problem. In low-income communities, we don't have that same wealth of resources, and we become much more likely to define the problem as a criminal justice problem than we provide police, prosecutors, and prisons. And so we have very similar issues, and yet, depending on the resources available, we address them in two fundamentally different ways with very severe consequences that just mirror the race and class dimensions of these communities.
Well, we'll see what happens with the Supreme Court case. Mark Maurer, Executive Director of the Sentencing Project, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Follow-up Friday continues in a minute. We'll follow up on the call-in we had last week on the 100 words that every high school graduate should know. This week, it's the 100 words that are most often used to misuse, to confuse. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Do you know a local hero who you think we should invite on the air? Visit the You Produce page of our website and suggest a guest. We really are looking for people who are not known to the media but who are heroes in your community. Go to WNYC.org and click on Brian Lehrer Show, then You Produce. Well, last week, as we continue with Follow-Up Friday, we had a call-in about the American Heritage Dictionary's list of 100 words every high school graduate should know. And we got so many calls and comments on our website, more comments on our website than on any segment we've had since we turned comments on a few weeks ago. Many of them about words that people misuse that we thought we would follow up this time with the editor of the 100 Word series, Steve Kleinedler. It turns out that one of the books in the series is specifically 100 Words Almost Everyone Confuses and Misuses. And so you can ask him about the editor's picks and yours. We have a link to the American Heritage List on our show page, WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. You can read the comments there, too. And there are words you can't keep straight, right? Or judging from past emails and comments, words that other people misuse that drive you crazy. Call us 212-433-WNYC. 433-9692 with what those words are for you. Either ones that drive you crazy because people misuse them and then you get confused, or words that you think people might even intentionally misuse, maybe in the political sector or wherever, intentionally misuse in order to confuse. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Or go to WNYC.org and click on Brian Lehrer Show, where some of this discussion is taking place on our comments page. Steve Kleinedler, welcome to WNYC. Hi there.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on.
I noticed, first of all, that it's and it's, IT apostrophe S and ITS, make your list. And we had that submission along with there, and there. Everybody knows what the three theres are. Use them in a sentence. Well, They're there to confuse you, and that's their problem. But my favorite submission may have been the person who wrote suggesting, in a similar vein, two and two and two, T-O, T-O-O, and T-W-O, and then he spelled vain, V-A-I-N. So for such a little word, this could all be very confusing.
That is correct, and this was a very popular book. People love to discuss, pet peeves. So it really gets people motivated, and it actually ends up being fun to talk about.
Was this list a group activity?
Yes. There are so far 100. There are 6 books in the 100 Word series, and editorial staff here at the American Heritage Dictionary gets together, and we decide collectively what we think should go in, and then of course we always end up with more than 100 words, and the particular project editor for any of the books will whittle them down to the 100 that we choose to use. The notes and the information in 100 words almost everyone confuses and misuses. We took a lot of that information from the usage notes that we put in the American Heritage Dictionary, along with the notes that we put in our Guide to Contemporary Usage and Style. And one nice thing about this book is it's small, it's compact, easy to carry around, and fun to read.
And you were confusing whittle and winnow.
That was more of a slip of a tongue rather than
a confused definition. Okay, here are a couple from the comments that have just come in. One person writes, my favorites are the ones that people use to sound more intelligent, end up misusing, and thereby sounding dumber. My favorite examples are bemused, which means confused, being used to mean amused,
right?
Which it doesn't even come close to meaning, right? Writes this person.
That is correct. There's another book in this series called 100 Words to Make You Sound Smart, which, despite the title, is not meant to make you sound pretentious or highfalutin, but rather it shows through the use of quotations how people use these words correctly. And, above all, and one of the common themes for this entire series of books is, we encourage people to bolster their vocabulary, use words appropriately, because, how you speak certainly conveys a lot about how people perceive you.
But maybe I'm confused about this, but I thought that bemused doesn't just mean confused, but it means confused with a tinge of amusement. Some sense of irony there or something.
No, there's 2 senses of bemused. One is this confusion sense, and the other is to be engrossed in thought. Any tinge of amusement that you get is due to, the fact that it looks like amuse, but there is no amusement inherent in the amusement.
All right, so I've learned something here already. And here's another one posted that says, how about the way we use the word decimate today? From freedictionary.com, it says, decimate originally referred to the killing of every 10th person, a punishment used in the Roman army for mutinous legions. So
I should point out that usage note on dictionary.com, it comes directly from the American Heritage Dictionary. Huh. That's one of our usage notes. We license...
You have an intellectual property issue then.
Yeah. Well, no, we license our content to a lot of online sources.
Oh, you do.
If you go down to the bottom of the thing, you'll see our copyright. Anyhow, that is one of our... That is one of our notes. But we go on to say in that very same note, if they continued further, we say that the meaning is commonly extended today to include the killing of any large proportion of a group. And in fact, 66% of our usage panel, which is a group of about 200 linguists and writers and journalists, people who use words every day for their living, accept that extension in the sentence. But if that meaning is extended to include destruction other than killing on a large scale, only 26% of the panel approve of that. Now, if you say that decimation can only refer to 1/10, that's a literal reading of the etymology, and it's a fact that words change over time. So yes, decimate has that highly technical sense, but that's an instance of a word that has moved beyond just what it might mean in Latin. So
yeah,
you've got some leeway there.
In fact, this may be a little bit morbid, but the person who wrote in said, using this meaning today, if you said the army was decimated, it's not so bad. Only 1 person out of 10 was killed. So that's their point of view.
Right.
Let's take a phone call. Jerry in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jerry.
Hi, how you doing today?
Good. What you got?
Homely and homey. I noticed that even on the BBC, shows like DIY shows, you know, for homes, they come into a room and they say, oh, this is very homely. Well, as far as I'm concerned,
that means ugly.
I was taught it's ugly.
Well, homely means both ugly or plain or lacking elegance, but it also means characteristic of a home or home life. So it's got that additional meaning to it.
Well, that's very confusing.
Yeah, that's English. There's a, look at words like cleave or sanction. Sometimes a word has a meaning that is opposite some of its other meanings. Homely can mean relating to a home.
Right. And homey generally just means it feels like home.
Exactly.
Right?
Cozy for.
Yeah. Okay. How about Stephen Huntington? You're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, I'm a philosophy professor, and I whenever I hear this, it boils my blood. I probably shouldn't, but I find myself writing emails to Matt Lauer, who misuses it, or the authors of at ESPN. I send letters. They say they mean that some situation raises a question or initiates a question, but instead what they say is that it begs the question, and then they follow it up with a question, but it doesn't mean that at all. To beg the question means to commit a very specific logical fallacy.
Yep. There's a whole, we have a whole page in our usage book devoted to beg the question. Here's the conclusion to our long note. The moral of the story is no matter how you use the expression, its ambiguity will likely turn off a sizable percentage of your audience. It's probably better to avoid the phrase entirely, which is something I suggest. It regardless of what is the correct usage, and I share your viewpoint. The fact is, it's also kind of cliche, and one's probably better off avoiding it.
Thank you. That's one of those things that maybe the lexicographers have to actually give up on after a while, because begs the question has so commonly come to mean avoids the question.
Yeah, it's not so much that we give up on it. It's just that we point out how it's used, and that if you use it, half your audience is going to misunderstand you, or if you use it the quote incorrect way, the part of your it's just avoidable. I would encourage people just not to use the phrase, just because it's one of those things that sets people off.
Here's another media related one that somebody wrote in: the word literally. A listener wrote that Bob Schieffer said John McCain literally blew up on the Senate floor today, which couldn't be right, or
yeah,
he
literally
wouldn't be running for president anymore.
I added that. That was one word. That was like probably the first word I chose to put in this. And, generally I'm pretty low-key as about how do people use words. It's just not so much a pet peeve of mine. It just ends up being funny. Anytime someone uses literal to mean really or actually, they usually end up undercutting their point because people snicker.
And back to the comments page, someone wrote, I have to mention one of the most obvious ones, whom. Is it really that difficult to use correctly? They're right.
Well, I think the objective case has dropped out in American English to a large extent. It's just another example of language changing. I'm not saying whether that's right or wrong, but the fact of the matter is the whom boat has left for most people. If you know how to use it and you can use it properly, that's fine. The thing that I don't like is when people use whom when they should use who. If you're going to use these forms, if you're going to use the correct forms, then use them correct. I think it's almost a greater sin to use one of these forms incorrectly than it is just to say who. You know, it's just like the whole between you and I thing. Everyone hears you and I, you and I, you and I. But after a preposition, you don't use that form. You use me after prepositions. You give it to me. And so it's between you and me. But when people say between you and I, it's like they're taking a rule and they're misapplying it. Ditto with whom. Sometimes you'll get people who use whom in frames that you should actually use who, and that's almost more annoying.
Hey, I want to come back to bemused
yep.
for a minute, because somebody wrote in the definition from Merriam-Webster, or is that Brand X, and I shouldn't mention it.
They're nice people. I know them.
And it's got three main entries for bemused, to make confused, like mm-hmm. you said, to occupy the attention of, like distract or
right,
absorb,
right.
it says. And number three is the way that I thought it could also be used, which says to cause to have feelings of wry or tolerant amusement.
They, interestingly, I'm checking the OED, that sense is not in the Oxford English Dictionary, but then again, in the third edition, they haven't gotten up to B yet. They started with M, and they're working their way around.
That wry or tolerant amusement.
I think that is a reading of the... I still think that's bemused, affected by amused. I mean, uh-huh. what I'm going to do now is...
So you're telling me lexicographers can disagree or
yes.
err?
Well, they can disagree. What I'm going to do now is, dredge through a lot of databases of a lot of newspapers and find, evidence for this use. And if it's warranted, it's something that we'd consider added. If it's something that I... it's a judgment call on to whether or not you think whether a sense has jumped over or not. If enough people use a particular sense, then it should go in. And it's just a judgment call as to whether or not it's like crossed that threshold. So what we do now, what the staff of lexicographers would do here, would be to go out and look at newspaper mm-hmm. archives and follow the trend lines.
So. Here's another one from the comments page. The perennial favorite for misuse is ironic for this person.
Oh, yes.
Who says ironic has become almost synonymous with coincidence if I
almost
go by
synonymous.
The people I talk to.
Yeah, well, we can thank Alanis Morissette for that. I like her music, but her use of ironic in her song, Ironic, was not ironic. We have a very long note about that in the dictionary and the style book, and this 100 words almost everyone confuses and misuses. But you're right, it is taken to mean coincidentally now, and I would still call that a usage problem. Interestingly, given enough context, if you look at the lyrics of her songs, very few of which are actually ironic, you can, when I was in graduate school, we'd get together and we would try to create context in which those unironic statements actually would be ironic. That's what we did for fun.
Right. And there are still two definitions of ironic that are properly used out there, right? One meaning something that happens that, it's a kind of, poetic justice maybe to end a situation. And the other, the ironic stance of a generation, or the writer cites Stephen Colbert as an example of irony.
Colbert's probably more accurately
satire.
Satire, mm-hmm. yes. Irony, very simply, from a the standpoint of literature, is the use of words to express something different from and opposite to their literal meaning, and that can be applied to drama, literature, that kind of. It's a literary style. It's a rhetorical device, and it can also refer to an incongruity between what could be expected and what actually occurs. And I would suggest that yes, Colbert is definitely that's satire
right.
on a grand scale.
We have 30 seconds left. I just want to mention that you were included in an article about hip young lexicographers in the New York Times a couple of years ago. When did you decide to make words your life's work?
Well, the tattoo that article referred to, I got in 1993. So at that point already, I was kind of headed down this path.
It's a tattoo of a phonetic vowel chart across your back.
Yes.
That's weird.
It's different, yes, but it's definitely, I think I can say that it is unique.
Thank you very much for coming on.
Well, thank you.
Steve Klein Edler, maybe you'll post your tattoo on the website sometime, but he is the, what's your title?
Senior editor.
Of the series 100 Words and the book we supervising editor of American Heritage Dictionary, and we were talking about the 100 Words series. Thanks a lot for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me on.
And we will leave you with one more follow-up. Yesterday, we had a search for common ground between bike riders, drivers, and pedestrians, and you may remember the divisions ran deep. In fact, we're planning to take a look next week at just why this kind of issue gets people so riled up. But here's one caller, our caller of the week, a former bike messenger who drew the ire of a few drivers on our comments page.
If I see a car or a driver misbehaving, I'll take out my bike lock and just tap them gently on the fender to make them aware that they are turning into traffic or pulling out without looking. I absolutely do not follow the rules of the road, absolutely not. I would never be able to make a dollar if I followed the rules of the road. However, I've never had an accident with a pedestrian or a car. If cars were able to break all the rules and never hit somebody, God bless them.
Ouch, said the drivers in many ways as they posted on our comments page at WNYC.org. That was an avid cyclist and former bike messenger, Octavio from Manhattan, who called in yesterday. And that's our follow-up Friday for this week. And that's our program for today on The Brian Lehrer Show, which is produced by Nuala McGovern with Jim Colgan, Priya George, Lisa Allison, and Nadia Zonis. Spencer Wilking with some help. And Tomek Gross. Have a great weekend. I'm Brian Lehrer.